When I was a teenager, which was in the 70s, no, actually it was in the 1950s.
That's right. it was a long, long time ago.
Well, I wish I had saved my copies of Mad Magazine. I had them all, I think.
Get $700 for number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Comics Con.
I also had the Walt Disney comics going back to about 1943, and I saw that a Donald Duck comic from the 50s was selling for $200.
Carl Barks. Did you know the author was Carl Barks?
No.
He was the unsung hero of Donald Duck comic books, and he worked hidden away under the Walt Disney imprimatur, but the people at the comics conventions know all about him. He was the guy who made Donald Duck fun.
Yeah. Now you were with EC Comics, right?
Yeah.
EC was the one that had the horror comic.
That's
series.
That's right. Yeah.
That I loved. Had Jack Davis, I think, did the illustrations.
Yeah, Jack's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
They had a few people. I was with Mad, of course, with EC, and I was always at war with the publisher because of the horror comics.
You did or did not like them?
Didn't like them, no. I liked the funny stuff that I did. But the horror stuff was great up to a point, and then it started getting kinky.
What do you mean, started getting kinky?
Well,
that's why we liked it.
they started the horror, the so-called horror line, horror, terror, mystery, with great classic short stories. And I think they ran out of classic short stories.
And Mad ever run across the evil hand of the censor in the way the horror series did?
Never.
Never at all?
Never. We didn't... There was no conflict of interest.
I had a feeling, though, that our elders were somewhat disgusted by Mad.
No, our response to Mad in the mail was good. It was friendly. We weren't all that controversial. Occasionally, we would do something like there was one great cover that I did that. Where the cover looked like a school book. You know, that marbleized notebook cover mm-hmm. that school books have. So you could carry it into school and read the comic book and people think you're doing your homework.
Mm-hmm.
We got some flack on that.
That was a wonderful idea, though.
It was a great idea. I copied it from what I used to do when I was going to school.
Yeah.
It's the way I conducted myself. Now, I don't know. I'm not advising that anybody do as I do or do as I say.
Well, the 1950s left. I went on to college. 60s came, and I kind of lost track of Mad Magazine and successors. I guess I should ask you, let's go back. Let's talk a little bit about you. The
yes.
publicity department here has... given me a two-page biography. You grew up in New York, and it says here that you literally were drawing cartoons on the sidewalks of New York.
Yeah, that's how I got my start in cartooning. I was always drawing. I guess it was something that came natural. And my first comic strip was on the asphalt of the gutter that I lived off of in the heartland of the Bronx.
Kids are still doing that now. They put the drawings in subway trains primarily.
Yeah, they call it graffiti now, and it doesn't wash off too easily. We used to work in chalk, and I would do an adventure every day. I could do that because the adventure from the preceding day would wash off from the traffic and the rain.
And I like your method better.
Occasional horse would come by, mm-hmm. and... We had our first
Had a
comic.
Horse laugh when he read the strip on the
Well, that's pretty good. So
then what happened after the After your career on the sidewalks.
I was lucky enough to go to the High School of Music and Art. And it's a great school. I don't know if you know the High School of Music and Art.
I saw Fame.
Huh?
Saw Fame. Is that the same one?
I think so. I think there's a connection. The performing arts and music and art are integrated somewhere. But I got a lot of support from teachers, and I went on to the comic book business.
What was your first job in the comic book business?
Erasing, sweeping, carrying lunch up from the street. I wasn't doing much when I started out in the business. Comics are divided into departments. There's a man who pencils, and then there's a man who inks, and there's a man who writes the stories. And the lowest rung of the ladder is the inker. And I became an inker.
Is this for EC?
No, this was well before EC, before the war.
What were you looking for at that time?
A guy by the name of Louis Furstadt. And he's long dead and gone. And he used to have a comic strip in the Daily Worker, I found out many years later. And he was making his income doing comic books. And he was actually a very fine artist, a failed fine artist.
I didn't know anybody laughed who read the Daily Worker.
Well, Louis' strip wasn't very funny. Louis' strip didn't get many laughs either. So I think you're right about that. But he was a sad comic book man because he didn't want to do comics. He wanted to paint. And he never got his chance to paint. He died after being in the comics business for a few years. And that was my beginning.
What were some of the titles?
Oh, Mr. Risk, Captain Midnight, Magno and Davy. I've got a terrible memory for these things, but I think I've named about 90% of what he did. He also ghosted the Flash, which still exists in DC Comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What happened after this apprenticeship?
Well, came the war, and I went off to be a soldier, and after a couple of years, I came back and picked up where I'd left off. Worked for Stan Lee of Marvel Comics. I think everybody knows the name Stan Lee. And I did a comic strip called Hey Look, which was a filler. I was never very successful at the beginning with comic books, and Stan Lee took a liking to me, and he had a problem with his comic books. He would have an empty page every now and then that had to be filled at the very last minute. And that's where I came in. I used to do these Hey Looks.
You actually illustrated the comic?
Yeah. No, I wrote it and drew it, and I did everything. And I had a success with other cartoonists, but that was about as far as it went. I didn't affect the public at all. But the cartoonists thought it was great. One person in particular working at the office thought it was so great she married me and is now my wife.
At what point did you join EC?
Well, things were pretty hard after I got back and did my Hey Looks and got married and one kid on the way. And I needed work badly. I started hustling all over the town. I ran into EC Comics, which ran under two titles, actually, Entertaining Comics and Educational Comics. And when they wanted a good opinion, they would call themselves Educational Comics. If they wanted to do something reckless, they would become Entertaining Comics. A real Jekyll and Hyde set of titles. And they liked my hey looks, but they didn't know what to do with them. But they decided to give me a chance at trying a mystery horror comic, which I did. And it came out good enough for me to become a regular.
What was that?
Oh, it was a haunted mansion. I don't even remember what the story was.
Did you draw this, or did you
produce
it, in effect?
I drew it.
Mm-hmm. And the whole book?
I penciled and I inked it.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Feldstein, who eventually became the editor of Mad after me, he was the writer. And that was my first job that I did for EC.
How did Mad come about?
Well, the comic books were having a hard time. They were being investigated. And at the same time, I was doing a line. I took a big jump in between Mad and my entry into the comics. I started doing a series of comics called War Comics, Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat. There, the particular theme of the war comics was to present war in all of its glory. I mean, the bad side of war was the theme of our magazines, and we created quite a stir with Two-Fisted Tales and Frontline Combat. Now, that was my first editorship when I did the war comics. And we caught on, became a trend, and that particular kind of comic really took a lot out of me, in the sense that I would have to do a lot of research. I spent a lot of time in the library. I spent a lot of time speaking to soldiers, getting real experiences, and it became overbearing. It was too much work. So we decided to look for a title that wouldn't be work. And I turned back to my early love, which was humor, which came naturally, and which all of my classmates encouraged me to do. And I did Mad Magazine.
So you created it from that viewpoint.
Yeah.
Do something easy that
I
like.
Do something easy. And I did some of the first issues in the hospital, because I really came down with a jaundice. And I was tired. And that's how I decided to do Mad.
Mad was really a smash, wasn't it?
Yeah. We knew we had something with the first couple of issues. The mail suddenly ballooned the volume. And
was it 10 cents at that time?
10 cent comic book, yeah. I think I did my best work in those 10 cent comic books.
You also upgraded to a slicker version, didn't you, sometime later?
Well, when the trouble came to the comic book industry, the investigations, the congressional investigation, we had to do something to get out of the category. We were in the comic book category, and all comic books were under fire. So for that and several other reasons, we turned to the so-called slick format, which is the format Mad uses today.
Now, what year did Mad start?
The 1950s, or I think it was around 54 or 56.
It's still running, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Matt?
Mm-hmm.
It's become a staple. No.
But you went on to other things.
I left Mad for all kinds of personal, complicated reasons. And I joined up with Hugh Hefner. Did a magazine for him that practically nobody is aware of. It was called Trump. And it was Hefner's first failure. Whatever Hefner did had turned to gold up to a point. And then we did Trump. And not that we did badly with Trump, but Playboy had been running into a bad period, and we had to stop. We were sort of stillborn.
Did it have the same format as Mad Trump?
No. It had more of the format of the Lampoon. It was on slicker paper, better printing. It was a more expensive format, a very expensive format. Hefner was a spender, and he was a pleasure to work with. I mean, we had a glorious time doing that first and second issue before we crashed.
Then what happened?
Well, I went on to a couple of other magazines. We're a long way from nuts.
We're gradually rolling up there, though.
We're going to get there. I did a couple of other mags. I decided to publish for a while. And I published a magazine called Help, another magazine called Humbug. And then there was Trump. And the outstanding thing about all three magazines is they all failed. And we just had some of the best people in the world working for us. And they eventually went on to do bigger and better things. We had people like... I had Gloria Steinem working for me.
That's right. That was her first job.
Yeah, Terry Gilliam. Woody Allen even helped us out once upon a time. But I won't dwell on that. So, in the meantime, I'd been dickering with Playboy, with Hefner, on doing a feature for Playboy, which I subsequently did, called Little Annie Fanny, which you may or may not have heard.
I remember that very well.
And that Fanny seems to have gotten the most attention, the most personal attention. That is, of all the things I've done, people that either identify me with the title Mad or with Little Annie Fanny, which is a dubious kind of a reputation. Now we get to nuts.
Okay, now we get to nuts. The cartoons and the comic strips in nuts, were these created specifically for these first two editions, or were they printed elsewhere?
They're printed for the first two issues. The two issues that you hold in your hand were drawn especially for the format that you see. We've got a lot of new cartoonists, young cartoonists, some of them out of the School of Visual Arts where I teach, and some of the young professionals that have been around. The cartoon quality is, we're fairly proud of what we've done, and we think we've got a winning continuity in Laurie and Versala, who are at the core of the magazine. I don't know if you've...
Yes, I see there's a running a theme all the way through the magazine that hooks all of the little stories and cartoons together.
Yeah, the format is continuous.
It's not just a hodgepodge of funnies. There seems to be some cohesiveness and an order to it.
Well, it was... very deliberate. You never stop. You're supposed to read the book and never put it down once you've started, once you're hooked, because the continuity is a continuity, and yes, yet it isn't.
Now
it's tricky.
There are two issues of Nuts that have been put out so far. These are aimed, I would assume, at teenagers.
Yes, they are. Age bracket was 13, 14.
It's essentially the same audience that Mad appeals to.
Well, yes, Mad has a 13-year-old audience, but when we started Mad, it was quite different than Nuts. I did Mad just to have fun for myself. It was a very egotistical effort. All I wanted to do was make myself happy when I did Mad. Here, we're taking aim and firing. which is slightly different than the MAT approach.
What do you mean taking aim and firing?
Well, we're looking to please the 13-year-olds. MAD, we just wanted to please ourselves. And
I see.
We had an interesting fandom in MAD. I mean, we reached people like Ernie Kovacs, who would tell us how he'd bring the MAD comic book into 21 and whip it out at the strategic moment. It was that kind of thing where men and women were reading MAD, but Nuts isn't designed that way.
Now, Nuts is aimed to come out in July of 1985. There are two issues or books. I don't know exactly how to describe it. Do I describe these as issues or books? Is this going to be a continuing publication or what?
Well, if we play our cards right, and if I say the right words over the radio right now, maybe we'll come out with more issues. We'd like to come out with a series.
Why did you decide to publish these simultaneously?
I wasn't in on the thinking. That's Bantam Books thinking, and I think it has to do with the fact that it's a summertime book. We're assuming that kids will be buying this book on their way to camp or when time hangs heavy on their hands, and Nuts will be just right for using their time. And I would think that two issues are better than one in filling the time that I'm talking about. These two issues are published simultaneously, and they're being distributed simultaneously.
Well, over the years, you must have made scores and scores of contacts of writers and artists. I guess you were able to call upon these creative minds to produce for you, huh? Did you call somebody and say, hey, listen, I need something? How did you work at it?
Well, actually, we tried a few things. We went to our tried-and-true connections. We also experimented with a few students who hadn't done any professional work before, and we tried to guide them into doing some things as we get a fresh and a new look and perspective.
Are you? What is your actual status? You're obviously not employed by Bantam, but
no.
Do you have the Harvey Kurtzman Productions, or how does it work?
I'm just a freelance editor, writer, cartoonist. Nothing more complicated than that. I have an interest in Nuts, in the sense if we sell copies, I'll get a royalty. But I'm not head of the company or the corporation.
What other things are you doing in addition to Nuts?
Well, there's still the things I do for Playboy. Annie Fanny goes on and on. And I do some commercial things, TV advertisements. And I write an occasional feature for other magazines. I was the cartoon editor of Vanity Fair for a while, Health Magazine, Esquire Magazine, stuff like that there.
Sounds like you have a lot of irons in the fire. Well,
I've been around a long time.
It's really been a thrill meeting you because it's your name that goes back to my adolescence, and I'd always wanted to talk to you. I have one last question for you, Harvey Kurtzman. How did Alfred E. Newman come about?
Well, we had this face that I picked up in, I think it was at Bantam Books, a long, long time ago, in the offices of a friend of mine by the name of Bernard Shercliffe. He had the What Me Worry face pinned on his bulletin board, and it was a pure original image that I thought I was looking at. I think it was a photograph. I borrowed it from Bernie and started using it in MAD, and everybody fell in love with the face The face was titled, What Me Worry, nothing else. We did a little research. We started asking around as to where the face came from, and we got all kinds of answers. Somebody said it was from Coca-Cola ad in World War I. Some people said it was a postcard, a Coney Island postcard. Somebody wrote in and said it was an illustration from a medical text showing a person deficient in iodine. That seemed to be the most logical version. The name Alfred E. Newman, Alfred Newman, was picked up from the title of the music man, Alfred Newman, the musical arranger from back in the 50s and 40s, which everybody knew but nobody could place. And we borrowed the name indirectly through the Henry Morgan show. He was using the name Alfred Newman. He'd use it for a character, an innocuous character that you'd forget in 5 minutes. And so we started using the name Alfred Newman, and the readers insisted on putting the name and the face together. And they would call the What Me Worry face Alfred E. Newman. So we didn't feel like fighting it, and that's what we have today, Alfred E. Newman.
Yeah, it's a face that all of us, we all think we have met or know Alfred E. Newman or had gone to school with him at some point. It's a very familiar face.
Well, it suggests recklessness, mischievous. He's a mischievous face.
Maniacal, perhaps.
I guess he represents the devil in all of us, that element that wants to break the rules. And
well, Harvey Kurtzman, you still have the devil in you, and you're still doing it with nuts, and I hope that the kids snap it up.
Well, I hope you're right.
Thanks a lot for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.